Rabbi David Silver, by the Haggadah, Yaakov Zinu Lomais.
Now branching out to be more of an institution that will let you be met with. So we look forward to even greater results. And tonight we'll be
speaking
to Rabbi
Chodesh Nisan and Pesach, and as David mentioned, yes, come out with the Haggadah, which is written by myself and Rachel first. And the Haggadah consists of 8 essays, which deal with, I would say, the biblical text of the grounding for the Haggadah, biblical roots of the Seder. And there's actual Haggadah with the underlying commentary, which is a focus on the structures, the Medrash. I think you'll find it interesting. It's called Seir Ramad. It is to encourage more thinking and learning. So I want to briefly speak this evening about one of the core questions of the Seder. Of course, the instructions for the Seder are found in the Mishnah. And the Mishnah says that the core text, according to the Mishnah, is the parasha of Mikra Bikurim, Arami Oved Avi, which is the recitation of the pilgrim, which is found at the end of the Chumash in the 26th chapter of Sefer Devarim. When you come into the land, you bring your first fruits to the temple, you give it to the Kohen, he places it next to the altar, and then you are to recite the Anita V'yamartu L'fnei Hashem Elokecha, and the recitation is Arami Oved Avi. It continues with the description of the suffering in Egypt and the calling out to God, and God took us out of Egypt, the Yad Chazakah, the Zohar, and the Tuyah. And then the pilgrim continues and says, and you brought us into this land, and here are the first fruits that I bring. And the pilgrim bows down, acknowledges a sense of gratitude for the gift of these fruits, the fruit of the land. And according to the Mishnah, this is the core text of the Seder. And the Mishnah adds, in addition, says, the Doresh Kol HaParsha Kuva. You are to engage in midrash on this parsha, the singular command that we have in all of our tradition to engage in the midrash. And we are following the dictates of the Mishnah for the most part. We don't read the entire parsha. The Haggadah as we have it is only the first 4 verses. The parsha continues. You brought me to the land, here are the Bikurim, this we don't say. But the first 4 psukim we do. And we also engage in a midrash. The Haggadah breaks up each of these verses into different parts and makes some kind of comment about the parts. Sometimes it cites other biblical verses, sometimes it doesn't. But the question I wanted to address this evening is the question of the choice of this particular parasha for the Seder. It is certainly an odd choice for 2 reasons. First of all, if we had to pick out a text for the Seder, no doubt we would pick one from the book of Exodus. We are discussing, after all, Yetziat Mitzrayim. The mitzvah is called Sefer Yetziat Mitzrayim. There is some text in the book of Shemot, the book of redemption, which would be appropriate, presumably, for the Seder. And yet we jump to the end of the Chumash, the Sefer Dvarim. Secondly, the particular choice in Sefer Dvarim is extremely odd, given the fact that the parasha they're talking about is Mikra Bikurim. And Mikra Bikurim is certainly something we don't identify with Pesach. The Chumash, in fact, calls it the holiday of Shavuot Yom HaBikurim. So what a peculiar choice for the Seder. In this Haggadah, actually, I have the first 2 essays are about exactly Arami Oved Avi. And if you see the Haggadah, you'll find them very interesting. I did want to focus in on the second of these essays, and to embellish somewhat what's in the Haggadah. that is this commentary on the Haggadah, and to deal with a particular point about the parsha of Arami Yoved Avi. And Arami Yoved Avi is this recitation describes the experience of the Jewish people. It begins by describing this Avi, my father. Doesn't say who the father is. Could be Abraham, who after all was an Aramean. Simple meaning of the verse is presumably the Aramean, my father, Avi, was an Arami Oved, Oved being an adjective. My father was a near to perish Aramean, was a lost Aramean. So presumably Oved is like the Hebrew Avud. It's the form of the adjectival of Avud. That probably is the most plausible interpretation of the words Arami Oved Avi. The Haggadah offers a midrashic interpretation, namely Arami refers to Lavana Arami. Oved tried to destroy my father. Whether that's the best or most plausible reading of the text or a drush is not our problem right now. But in any event, this Avi, maybe it's Abraham who was an Aramean, maybe it's Jacob who was not an Aramean, but who lived with the Aramean in the house of Lavan, or maybe it's some paradigmatic father, neither of the two, but my paradigmatic father, who knows, went down to Mitzrayim, Vayagar Sham Bim Teimad, he dwelt there with few in number, there he became many, that's the first pasuk. And the second pasuk is, Vayareu Otanu HaMitzrim Vayanunu, so the Egyptians harmed us, let's say Vayareu has harmed us, perhaps. Now God understands it differently, but that's the simple meaning. In Vayanunu, they oppressed us, Inui. In Vayinu Olenu Avodah Kasha, they placed upon us hard Avodah, which presumably refers to basically slavery. We were slaves in the land of Egypt. And these first two verses, which describe our situation in Mitzrayim, contain three important words for our purposes this evening. The first is the word that appears in the first verse, which describes our father as Vayagar Sham. He was a stranger. He was a ger. And the second verse contains two other descriptions of our experience in Egypt, namely Vayanunu, we were oppressed, abused, the Hebrew Inui, and finally Avodah Kasha, we were slaves, Avdus. So we have these three terms which describe our experience in Egypt. We were strangers, Gerim, Gerut, Avdus, and of course Inui. And these three terms found in Arami Oved Avi are of course the same three terms that we find in the promise that was made to Abraham, the covenantal promise about the land. That is to say, in the 15th chapter of Bereshit, when God says to Abraham, it's going to be okay, your reward is very great, Abraham says, I have no successor. So God says, don't worry about it, your descendants will inhabit this land. And Abraham says, how do I know it? Through what may I know that I will possess it? What is the price? What does it cost us to possess this land? And God responds, take these three sets of animals, three three-year-old animals and two birds, and to cut the animals in half, and the birds are not cut. And then God begins to speak. You ask me how, through what shall I know? And let me tell you, know very well. What should you know very well? That your descendants will be strangers. Enslaved and tortured for 400 years. Gerus, Avdus, and Inui. Exactly the three terms that appear in the first two verses of Arami Oved Avi. And then God continues, you will die Gam et hagoy asher yavodu don anochi, the ones that enslave them, I will judge, punish. V'achreichein yetzu b'rechus gadol. And then God continues, and you will die in ripe old age. V'yatot avol avotech v'shalom tikaveh v'teva tova. And v'dar v'yi yoshuvu heina, but the fourth generation shall return to the land. Ki lo shalem avon emori ad heina. For the sin of the Amori is not yet complete. That's what we call, on that day, the Torah says, God made a covenant with Avram. Karat Hashem Brit et Avram. Concerning the land. Brit ben Abitarim. The price, Gerut Avdus and Inu. Now, there's actually something very interesting about this covenant. This awesome, actually awesome moment in the Chumash. Eimel Gedolach HaSheikha Nofel et Olaz. The terrible dread falls upon Avram. And what's interesting is, of course, the covenant itself has a kind of internal problem. So on one hand, God speaks of 400 years, which is presumably 10 generations. A generation in the Bible is 40 years. But then God speaks also of the fourth generation returning to the land. How does that work? But the deeper question is, exactly to whom does God refer in this covenant? How does this covenant play out? Before I get to that question, which is the subject of this evening, I wanted to point out that there's something else interesting about the nature of the covenant. And that is that God speaks of four generations. The fourth generation shall return to the land. But also, Avram takes animals. Three sets of animals he cuts in pieces and divides them. But the fourth set, which are two birds, V'yetat Tzipor says, Lo Batar. He does not cut them in pieces. So what is the significance of the animals? That is, these animals presumably are related to the nature of the covenant. So what would appear to be most plausible is that the three animals that are cut in pieces were also Meshureshet, three-year-old animals, three sets, presumably represent the three generations that suffer. Because the three generations are going to endure the triple Geirut, Avdut, and of course Inui. But the fourth generation shall return to the land. They're represented by the birds. But the birds are not cut. So what does that mean? It means those that suffer do not possess. And those that possess do not suffer. Now certainly that is true in terms of one of the fulfillments of this covenant in the Chumash. And that is the generation, the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. The generations that are enslaved in Egypt and the ultimate possessors of the land are not the same people. The people that suffer in Egypt, the Geirut, the Avdut, and the Inui, as we'll see shortly, they don't possess the land. And the ones who possess the land, they never suffer. The children never suffer. In fact, the truth of the matter is, I knew this the moment I picked up the Sefer Shemot. Right away, you know it immediately. Or at least, the Chumash hints at it right away. Because the suffering of Egypt begins, the Torah tells us, in the book of Exodus anyway, with the death of Yosef and all his brothers. And the Chumash adds, Yomad Yosef v'chol echav v'chol hadar rahu. Why does the Chumash say v'chol hadar rahu? Strange. Chumash could have said Yomad Yosef v'chol echav v'yokom melech hadash asher lo yada et Yosef. But why does the Torah mention the generation? And the answer is, because the Torah wants you to count out the generations. The suffering begins after the generation of Joseph dies. So let's say Levi is his brother. Levi died. No suffering. Begins with Levi's son. Who is Levi's son? Kahat is one of them. Who is Kahat's son? Amram. Second generation. Who are Amram's sons? Moshe and Aaron. So what is Moshe? It's the third generation Jew. As we count out the generations. So we know something he doesn't know. He's going no place. And neither is his generation. And that's actually a very important point. course, the real audience for Moshe is not his contemporaries, who go no place. The real audience, in a sense, are the children. And the children, they were never slaves in Egypt. They're the ones that possess the land. And where does possession of the land begin in the Torah? Where is the story in which we begin to possess the land? Reuven and God is not the beginning. Now, it's not a bad answer, but I don't think it's a correct answer. In other words, true about Reuven and God. But, and actually they won't fully possess it later on, say for Yeshua. They're given title to it in a conditional title, no doubt. But the actual possession of land, yes. I'm saying in the story of the Jews that leave Egypt, Abram's buying of the land is certainly an act of symbolic acquisition, no doubt, and a very important one. But Bnei Yisrael, someone said it. Was it? No, Yericho is not in the Torah. Yericho is in the book of Joshua. We cross the Jordan, that we actually begin to possess the land before we cross the Jordan. It's a story of immense significance, by the way, for 100 reasons. The story is simply the conquest, the defeat of Sichon. That's the whole point in the Chumash. Sichon is a Canaanite king, but he actually possesses land on the other side of the Jordan. How is that possible? So the Torah explains, because Sichon defeated Moab and took their land. Right? Ki Cheshbon, right? Cheshbon is Melech Moab. Who nilcham, ki se Melech Amori, who nilcham in Melech Moab Arishon. Who is Sichon? Sichon is who? Sichon Melech or Amori. Sichon is an Amorite king. And he represents the beginning of the conquest. That's how Sefer Devarim begins. Acharei Akol Tzoe Sichon, right? Melech HaShem Shev Yetz, Og Melech HaBot. Sichon and Og, the great conquest, in the Torah. When do we defeat Sichon, by the way? When is Sichon defeated in the Chumash? This is not the subject of tonight's lecture, but just anyway, basic stuff. When do we defeat Sichon in the Chumash? Chapter 21 of the book of Bamidbar. 21 of Bamidbar. And what happens in chapter 20 of Bamidbar? Very important chapter. What happens in chapter 20? You don't have to know it. You can look it up. So, chapter 20 of Bamidbar begins with one death and ends with another death and a predicted death in the middle. It begins with the death of Miriam and ends with the death of Aaron. And in the middle of the chapter, Moshe is told something. He won't possess the land. That's chapter 20. That is to say, the death of the first generation. 21 begins the emergence of the second generation. Sichon. That's the story of Sichon. Sichon Melech HaEmori. What did the Chumash, what did God say to Abraham in the covenant? The Dari V'i Yashuvu Heina. Why so? Ki Lo Shalem Avona Emori Ad Heina. For the sin of the Emori is not yet complete. Interesting is, normally in the Chumash, the generic name for the Canaanites, who are a bunch of different nations, is of course Canaan, Eretz Canaan. Sometimes the Chumash deviates from that and becomes Emori. Not too often. Sometimes. Every time we gotta be very... In the Chumash, it's Avon HaEmori. The fourth generation shall return to the land, for the sin of the Emori is not yet complete. And that fulfillment takes place, of course, in the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. The generations that suffer do not possess. And the generation that possesses never suffered. Now you might ask the question, that's very nice. Who cares? That's a good question, actually. And the answer is, there's a deep teaching over here about the nature of the covenant. The covenant takes place over four generations. The covenant is a function of two different experiences. The experience of those who suffer and the experience of those who possess. Each one needs the other. Each one alone is actually insufficient. And that's what the Seder is all about. Not all about, but that's one very important point about the Seder, that we see our own experience as deeply related to those that left Egypt. And by the way, one could ask a very simple question. Why do we celebrate the Exodus from Egypt in the first place? They got out of Egypt, they walked around in circles for 40 years, and they all dropped dead. What are we celebrating? why don't we start with entering the land? And the answer is no. Because the entering of the land, the fourth generation, is deeply connected to the first generation. We all need each other. We're all part of a bigger community. It doesn't mean the community that exists now. It's over time. The community over time consists of every generation linking up with the next one. And that's true of the very covenant itself. The very covenant itself is a function of these two very different experiences of those that suffer and lay the groundwork for those who possess. And those who possess never suffered. The etat sipar lobatar. The birds were not cut in pieces. The others, the sufferers, are represented, the three generations, by the three sets of animals. So Rami Yoved Avi contains within it, the first two verses, a reminder of the covenantal price we pay, Gevut Avdut and Inui. And if you open up the book of Shemot, you see straight out that the Torah describes this experience as Gevut Avdut and Inui. Because in chapter 1, when the new king of Egypt emerges, there it says that, and he warns the people about the dangers of the Jews, a fifth column has drawn up with the enemies, and because of this, and because he's afraid lest we multiply, Pen Yer Bay, he says, well, he's afraid, we're going to multiply, he appointed over us taskmasters to oppress them, Inui, the Chasher Ya'anu also. But no matter how much inui he imposes, it doesn't matter. We continue to multiply. And in the next pasuk, in Yud Gimel, Vayavidu Mitzrayim et bnei Yisrael b'farech, Vayemaru et chayehem v'avodah kasha, v'chomer duvenim, v'chol avodah basadeh, v'chol avodatam, asher avdu b'hem b'farech. You have five times in these two verses, the same word that repeats, Ayim Bet Dalet. The Shorish for Avodah, Vayavidu, Avodatam, right? It means Avdu. So we have in these few verses, the experience of Israel in Egypt is Inui, and the experience of Israel in Egypt is Avdu. So we have two of the three covenantal terms straight out. What is missing? Gerut is missing. No Gerut. So we keep reading. But unfortunately, in chapter 1, you won't find the Gerut. So you read chapter 2. And in chapter 2, we do find it. Chapter 2, of course, is the chapter of the birth of Moshe. And the story, as we know, he's born, he's given to Pharaoh's daughter, nursed by his own mother, goes out into the world, he's the suffering of his people, he kills the Egyptian. In short, he's forced to run away, he runs to Midian, he goes to a well. And when he gets to the well, at the end of the second chapter, he sees the daughters of the priest of Midian at the well, the seven daughters, and some guys are pushing them around, shepherds, he doesn't like it, so he intervenes on their behalf. They come home to their father, how come you're home so early? I guess they were pushed around all the time. Oh, some Egyptian guy saved us. Ish Mitzri, where is he? He saved you. Bring him home. Kirin Rovi Yochal Lachem, Moshe loves the father-in-law, Ayom Moshe, Shevet Ish, gives him Tzipora as the wife. And what happens? Vatela ben, Vayigrat Shemo Gershom. Chiyomar, Gera Yiti Bi'eretz Nachriyah. Bernie, you want to say something?
That's a question. You asked why we don't celebrate the Jews came into Eretz Yisrael. Why do you celebrate the Exodus? The Jews come into Eretz Yisrael on Pesach, and in a sense, perhaps, the inclusion of Bikurim may, in a sense, reflect that. I mean, in a certain sense, at least in terms of the calendar.
That is true, that in Sefer Yoshua, and all that's true. And by the way, there are many reasons that Rami Yoved Avi is an appropriate choice. I'm just focusing on one of them. Having said all that, I still think that the Bikurim Parsha is obviously in the Chumash, one that is identified with Shavuot, not with Pesach. So the question, in a sense, still stands. Your point is well taken. Let me just finish this one point about the Gerus. Moshe calls his son Gershom, for he says, I was a stranger in a strange land. I presume that refers to Egypt, not to Midian. He says, I realize now I'm settled in Midian. I have a wife, I have a kid, I have a job, I have a father-in-law that I love dearly. And the moment he says this, plus one can ask the question, does Moshe's understanding that he's a ger count for us? Okay, Moshe says he's a ger, but the people don't say they're gerim. The people say nothing of the sort. Is Moshe's realization he's a ger sufficient for God to give us credit that we have fulfilled that part of the bargain? From a logical standpoint, we could argue no. But the Chumash seems to say yes. Because the very next pasuk is, right away, Moshe names his son Gershom, and the Torah continues, Vayi vayamim arabim ahem, vayamat noach mitzrayim, vayanchum en avoda, vayizaku. Vatau shavatam el ohim min avoda. Vayishmao him en nat batam, vayizkau him et rito et Abraham, et Yitzchak et Yaakov, Vayar Elohim et Bnei Yisrael, Vayeda Elohim. Immediately, God is hearing, God is remembering, God knows, God remembers the covenant. Interesting, by the way, a small detail that's interesting, is that in this little description of God remembering the covenant, two things are striking. First of all, that the Torah says, their cries ascended to God, right? Min ha'avoda, min ha'avoda. Vayeyanchu Bnei Yisrael min ha'avoda. They cried from the slavery, and the cries ascended to God, min ha'avoda. Why did the Torah mention min ha'avoda? Of course min ha'avoda, it's also the Inui. Why didn't the Torah say the cries ascended to God in heaven? We know it's min ha'avoda. Why does the Torah emphasize min ha'avoda? Five times in the first chapter it says min ha'avoda. This is seven times. But what's the focus? Min ha'avoda. If you remember the covenant, what did God say about the covenant? There'll be Gerus, and there'll be Avdus, and there'll be Inui. And then God said, the garments are going to show you how Vodu Don Anochi. The nation that is Ma'at, that enslaves them, I will judge. When it comes to the judgment, it's about the slavery. So Min HaVodu, the Torah emphasizes that God is remembering, and God is seeing, and that is how the little parasha ends. Vayar Elohim et Bnei Yisrael, Vayeda Elohim, and God knows. Take us back to the covenant, which begins, of course, with the words, Yadoa Tezah, that what? Kigeri Ezaracha. And what does it say over here? He names his son Gershom. Immediately, God knows. God remembers. In other words, God is very generous in this case, and Moshe's perception of the Gerut counts for all of us. In a way, Moshe's emblematic of all the people. He's the little boy also thrown into the water. Okay, he's drawn out of the water. But he experiences, in a sense, what the Jewish people experience. And therefore, it counts as a covenantal fulfillment. Now, one here can ask the obvious question, which is, actually there are many questions, but one of them is that the order that we have in Sefer Shemot is not the same order that we have in God's covenantal promise to Abraham. There is Ger first, and then Avdut, and then Inui. In Sefer Shemot, Ger is at the end, and in fact, it's interesting that Avdut and Inui are also switched. The Inui comes first in Sefer Shemot, and then the Avdut. So let me deal only with the question of the Gerut, and not why the Inui and Avdut are switched. First of all, the first thing is to notice the problem. That's half the battle. I have a lot of answers, but the problem is the key. The Gerut is very important. And the point of the Chumash is, it's only Moshe who names his son Gershom. And it's only Moshe who recognizes he's a stranger. And part of that, no doubt, is the fact that Moshe actually leaves. In other words, the recognition that you are a stranger is a function of the distance you have from that experience. Because knowing you're a stranger is not the same as knowing you're being enslaved and beaten or abused. Knowing you're a stranger means, that's not my place. It means you have your own identity. But it's a lot easier to gain a sense of one's own identity and to see what's wrong with the other when you have the critical distance. So only after Moshe leaves, he goes to Midian. He looks back. He looks back at Egypt. And he says, you know something? That was never for me. Gera yitivi eretz nachriya. To explain this better, actually, and to come to one of the core points of the Haggadah, let me explain it in this way. The fact of the matter is, when you open up the Chumash, and God says to Abraham, the Dari of the Iyashuvu Heina, the fourth generation shall return to the land. Let us assume we know nothing. We open up the Chumash. Who is the fourth generation? We would all agree, I think, without question, the fourth generation, God is speaking to Abraham. So he's generation number one. And the second generation is his child, the son, Isaac, let's say. And the third generation would be his grandson, Yaakov. And the fourth generation would be Jacob's children, Bnei Yisrael. That would be a very reasonable way to read the Psukim. And of course, that way of reading the Psukim is 1,000% correct. That actually is the Pshat in Chumash. And it's very important to understand that. That reading, that the covenant itself is actually open-ended. Who are the generations? One fulfillment we have seen in the book of Exodus, it's Bnei Yisrael. It's the three generations and their children that possess. But what about in the book of Exodus? What about in Sefer Bereishit? So it turns out that in Sefer Bereishit, we also have the triad of Gerut, Avdut, and Inu. In fact, we have it twice in Sefer Bereishit. Three times if you count the promise. But I'm not going to get into that now. I'll mention one such fulfillment and the implications of it. The implications of it. This I've said in the past, by the way, but what I'm going to say next, I haven't said in the past. New, actually new. It's new for me anyway. Maybe you've thought of it, I don't know. Jacob runs away to the house of Laban. Right? Why does Jacob run away to the house of Laban? There's actually two reasons why. One reason is that his brother is threatening to kill him. So his mother says, Yaakov, you better leave. Go for a few days, she says, so his wrath abates. Yomim achadim. He has to run away because he harmed his brother, he hurt his brother's feelings or whatever, he took his blessing. He has to run away. That's one reason. And there's another reason he has to run away. He runs away because when he goes to his father, and his Rivka says to Yitzchak, I can't take these Canaanite women anymore. So Yitzchak calls in Yaakov in the beginning of the 28th chapter. So I want you to go, he says, to your mother's house and take for yourself a wife from the house of Laban, your mother's brother. And God should bless you and give you the blessing of Abraham to inherit the land of your sojournings. Chapter 28, the first three psukim. So that's different, actually. He's going to Laban's house not to run away from his brother. He's going to Laban's house to find a wife, a non-Canaanite wife. The same way Avram sent his own servant to find a wife for Yitzchak. And the two reasons are not just two different reasons. They're totally different reasons. They're different reasons, the opposite in a way. Because the running away from Esav, basically, is fundamentally punishment. In other words, one can read the experience of Yaakov in the house of Laban as a punishment for Yaakov. You hurt your brother. You tricked your blind father. You're paid back in the same way, a kind of mida keneged mida. When I was a kid, I acknowledged people that have been my teachers over time. And I mentioned the story about Casuto, actually, how I came into that personal contact with the works of Umberto Casuto had a big impact on me. And by accident, I came across his interpretation of Genesis chapter 27. That's his point. Everything that happened to Yaakov in the house of Laban is payback for what he did to Esav, what he did to Yitzchak. It's a very compelling interpretation, but it is an insufficient one. It's correct, but not enough, because it's true. But there's another reason to go to the house of Laban, which is not about punishment. I would call it covenantal opportunity, because in order to enter into the covenant of Abraham, he can't marry the Canaanite women. So he has to go to the house of Laban to find the appropriate wife, the appropriate partner, which allows him to get the covenantal blessing, Birkat Abraham. And when Yaakov goes to Laban's house, of course, and the question always is something a punishment or is it covenantal? And how do you know? What is the difference between them? So Yaakov goes to the house of Laban. He goes there for 30 days, and Laban says to him, because you're my brother, you should work for nothing. Of course, Yaakov never mentioned working, you understand, but what are your wages? So Yaakov falls into the trap. I'll work 7 years for Rachel, your youngest daughter. So she's a payment for his labor. And from there, things get very complicated and very messy for Yaakov. and he works 7 years, and at 7 years he thinks he has his beloved Rachel. Doesn't work out that way. There's another 7 years. He's worked 14 years for nothing, right? He works for less than nothing, I'd say. That's what he works for. And then he has an opportunity to leave, but he doesn't, because he sees a business opportunity to stay. He's going to manipulate the flocks of Laban. So he stays another 6 years. At the end of 20 years, he's a wealthy man. But he looks at Laban's face. He says, uh-oh. And then God, he hears God's voice. Basically, God says, get out. So Yaakov goes to the wives. We have to leave. We have to run away. I had a dream. And they run away, and Yaakov steals away in the night, says the Chumash. But he ignores Yaakov and leaves Lavana. And Laban chases after him and catches up with him and confronts him and accuses him. And Yaakov says, I didn't take you, I stole nothing, I didn't steal your gods either. He doesn't know Rachel had taken the trophim. If you want to go search, go search. So what does Laban do? Searches his tent, the wife's tent, everything. And when he comes out, finds nothing, then Yaakov gets angry. It took him 20 years. He gets angry. And what does he say to Laban? He says, what have I done wrong? He said, you changed my wages 10 different times. I worked 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for the tzon. You changed my wages 10 times. And in Perek Lamed Aleph, if not for the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac, you would have sent me away with nothing. It's on Yivi as Yigiyah Kapai. It's right in the Chumash. Perek Lamed Aleph with the Pasuk Mem Aleph, Mem Bet. Ro'ayim v'yochach Amish. So what does Yaakov say to Laban? He says, first, Avadaticha. How do you translate avaditicha? Is it I work for you or I slave for you? I would translate I slave for you. After all, what's the difference between a worker and a slave? A worker can always quit. That's the Gemara, the main difference. Yaakov can't just quit. Can't leave. A worker is paid a fair wage. You change my wages 10 times. A worker is a human being. A slave is basically not a person. A slave has no dignity. You can go into the slave's house, most personal places, because it's not a person. Avadaticha, says Jacob, for 40. Interesting is the word avoda, by the way, appears in the story of Yaakov and Laban, and you can count this up 14 times. 7 before the birth of Yosef, 7 after the birth of... The 14th time it appears is the pasuk avadaticha abas reshana. It's really true, I'm not making it up. Check it out for yourselves. I slaved for you for 20 years. And not just that. Last night the God of my father and grandfather appeared to you. Why? Et on yivi et yigia kapai. God saw my on yi, my inui. So what is Jacob saying? How is Jacob describing his experience of 20 years? Avoda and inui. Two of the three covenantal terms. It took him 20 years to come to the realization, but he comes to it. What's missing, of course? Geirus. He didn't say to Laban, I'm a geir. So what do we do? Keep reading. You finish chapter 31, you read chapter 32. Esav's waiting for him, right? He sends the messengers to Esav. He tells the messengers what to say. What does he say to the messengers? Tell Esav what? In Laban Gazi, you jump out of your seat when you read it. If you have a feel for the Chumash, you got to feel the Chumash, you know? Not just to learn the words, to feel it. It's a living thing. Imulavan, you know that word is coming. Imulavan garti. Only when he leaves. Not when he's talking to Lavan. Because when he talks to Lavan, he can never say garti. He's too close to Lavan. He hates Lavan's guts. It doesn't matter. He's there. So he leaves. In looking back, he says that to the messengers, he's talking about Lavan. Let me tell you something. I was a ger. I was estranged. Never my place. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same as you have with Moshe and Israel in the first chapter. Now, let me tell you something. My wife actually noticed this many, many years ago. Not so much about the Geirus being later, but about the parallels. But before my wife, Devorah, and before me, somebody else noticed it before us. You know who it is? I don't know about Rashi. The Haggadah Shal Pesach noticed it. Seu v'mad ma'bikesh lovan ho'aram ilasos li'akov avinu. Right? After we say the Haggadah, the way it works, it quotes the covenant with Abraham. Right? Baruch Shomer Haftachasu Yisrael Baruch Hu. And we quote the Brit made up sign, not the whole thing. Afu V'achrechen Yitzu B'chush Gadol. That's a different shiur. We always stop short at the Seder. We never have the whole citation. We end with the Yitziat Mitzrayim. They leave with a lot of wealth. And then we say what? V'hisha Amdo Avotenu. Means the promise, the covenantal promise, has stood us in every generation. It's not just a one-time thing. It could be even there every generation. Omdim Oreinu. Seyo Lamad. Go and learn about this deep truth that the covenant repeats more than once. Where do we learn it from? Seyo Lamad Mabike Shlovan Harami Laslo Sliyakov Avinu. What does that mean? It means, says the Haggadah, my beloved reader, there was an exodus from Egypt before we even got to Egypt. Because it's true. Because the experience of Jacob and in Laban's house and the experience of Israel in Egypt is the same experience. That's what it means, Arami Oved Aviva Yered Mitzrayimah. It's not a causal connection. Because after all, Yaakov doesn't go from Laban's house down to Egypt. He leaves the house of Laban in chapter 31. He goes to Egypt in chapter 46. In between, many things happen in the land of Canaan. Esau and Dinah and Yosef, the death of his wife Rachel, many things. It's a conflation of the two stories. They are the same story. You think it happened one time? It's not just one. And the truth of the matter is, it's the Pshat and Chumash. Because the very open-endedness of the covenant means it can refer to more than one thing in the Torah. It refers to two things. It refers to the fulfillment on the level of the family, which is the book of Bereishit. On the level of family, Jacob is third generation. Who is fourth generation? What is the fulfillment of the fourth generation shall return to the land? On the simple level, it refers to Jacob's children, who are possessors of the land. In what story do Jacob's children possess the land and Jacob doesn't? What is the story? Shem. Of course, in the story of Shem, they're the ones who conquer Shem. Whatever you think of the story, it's the conquest of Shem. The story of Shem is clearly a story in which the sons of Jacob do the conquest. He's against it. He says, you betrayed me, right? The truth is, that's what I used to think. It's not that it's wrong, but I came to a very good understanding of how it works in Sefer Bereishit, but that would take us an entire hour to explain it. But it's quite good, and very pleased with myself, I gotta tell you. But anyway, the point is, but let's say minimally, there is a fulfillment in Bereishit through Jacob and Jacob's son. It's actually more complex. And there's a fulfillment in later, with Israel and Egypt, the three generations, and the fourth generation, of course, is the beginning of the possession of the land, which is Dorivi'i Yashuvu'ena, Kiyoshalem Avona Emori Arhena. And by the way, coming back to my earlier question, what makes Jacob has run off to the house of Laban for two reasons. One is punishment, to escape his brother. He hurt his brother. And the other is to marry the wife, which is covenantal. And what determines whether something is covenantal or punishment? What is the difference? It's the same experience. But what determines if it's covenantal or not? Jacob, after 20 years, uses the covenantal language, the covenantal formula of Gerut, Avdut, and Inui. So Jacob understands it to be covenantal. But what distinguishes covenantal from simply punishment? What distinguishes it is how you understand it. If it's an experience that you have learned from, we call that covenantal. If it's simply unpleasant, that's punishment. And actually the greatness of Yaakov, that's his greatness actually, is his ability to reinterpret himself, to transform himself. If you had asked Yaakov 10 years earlier, or 3 years earlier, when he's busy with the speckled and the spotted animals, doing his genetic engineering, how's life here with Laban? Great. I love it here. Look at my animals. Look at the spots we have here. No doubt. No doubt. So Laban, D.K. Schlag, Laban is so dangerous for Yaakov. So dangerous. Because there's a Laban in Yaakov. That's the point of the Chumash. And the ability to transform, to become something other, which is his greatness, actually. To become Yisrael. to reevaluate his past. That's what Yaakov's all about. In any event, he transforms unpleasantness into covenantal experience. He defines it this way. It's Yaakov that says it, love and guarantee. The Torah doesn't say it, Yaakov says it. Now let me tell you something which is very interesting. You know, we talk about Geirus, Avdus, and Inui. That's the covenantal formula. So the question is, what does it mean? I mean, one can ask a prior question. Why must we suffer to enter into the covenant? What is the idea of suffering to enter into the covenant? That's actually a very important question. And what I believe it is, to the extent we can understand it, one could, of course, say this is God's will. But if you want to understand it from our perspective, in the Chumash, it would appear that two things. Number one, things that are of great value. The greater the thing is, the more value it has, the greater price you pay. There is no such thing as a unilateral covenant. That doesn't exist. Covenant, by definition, is two-sided. And furthermore, if something has ultimate value, you're willing to pay the ultimate price. But beyond that, the idea of the Geirut, the Avdus, and the Inui is spelled out in Sefer Shmot in more than one place. V'ahavtem et hager, ki gerim heitem b'yeretz Mitzrayim. V'atem yedatem et nefesh hager. In other words, the idea of the suffering is preliminary to setting up one's own society. A society in which people on the margins are treated properly, whether it's the ger, the yatom, the levi, the almana, or whatever, which the Torah makes a tremendous emphasis on over and over again, and it makes the point that you know what it's like. You should understand it, because after all, you yourselves were on the other side of it. You were strangers. You were marginal people. You were in the place that hated the stranger. Try it. Right? Can you bear? You know what it's like to be there. Don't impose this on the other guy. So that the suffering is preliminary in the Chumash to possessing the land. And now the question is, this suffering that's imposed on you, is it just suffering that happens to happen? Or need there be an acceptance of the suffering? So I want to make a suggestion that the Haggadah believes that you require an actual acceptance of the suffering, and that in the Chumash, we can read in the Chumash a story in the Torah where somebody actually, knowingly, accepts the suffering. When Yaakov runs to the house of Laban, he doesn't run there to suffer. He runs there to find a wife. His mother said, "You'll come back in a few days." Of course, God corrects him along the way. Won't be a few days. We'll get to that. But there's no sense, when he first leaves home, that he's going there to suffer. He doesn't know what lies ahead. He doesn't know who Laban is. But there is another story. The story of Yaakov running off to the house of Laban is chapter 28. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. And everybody knows when he leaves, he has a dream. In this dream, he sees the angels going up and down this staircase of this ladder. Malachei Elohim olim v'yardim bo. And God speaks to him, "I am the God of your father." Right? And I'm going to bless you with a family. Your children will be many. Right? And Jacob wakes up. He didn't realize it's such a holy place. And he makes promises to return and promises to build what he calls God's house. I'm going to build the house. By that he means not just a physical house. He means I'm going to do something no one's ever done before me. To build a kind of inclusive community. A family which every member of this family is part of the covenant. Abraham couldn't do it. Isaac couldn't do it. Jacob does it. It's not simple. Because the family of Yaakov consists of all kinds of animosities, hatreds, jealousies, etc. Most of the blame can be laid probably at the feet of our beloved Jacob himself. He's the source of his own problems. He favors one, not the other, etc. In any event, that's the first time Jacob leaves to run away into exile. And what is the second time that Jacob leaves to run away into exile? Not to run away, but he's directed to go into exile. That's the 46th chapter of Sefer Bereishit. If you take a look at Perek Mem Vav, it's very interesting. Perek Mem Vav, Yaakov has just heard that Yosef is still alive. All he says, I want to see my beloved Joseph, Echavi Yarenu, B'Terem Amud. I want to see Joseph before I die. It's reminiscent of going to the house of Laban at Rebekah's command. You go there for a few days. You go to my brother, you find a wife, I'll call you back in a few days. But then God speaks to Yaakov in Perek Mem Vav. And where does Jacob leave? By Yisai Yisrael v'chol Asheru, by Yavol, v'Eir Hashava. He goes to Beersheba. That's the jumping off point in chapter 46. It's also the jumping off point in chapter 28. By Yetze Yaakov mi Beersheba. And on the way, in the first instance to the house of Laban, God appears to Jacob. Jacob is asleep at night. Kibar Shemesh. And he has a vision of the night. And in chapter 46, after Yaakov brings sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac, Vayomer Elohim Yisrael b'marot ha'layla, God appeared to Jacob at night, in a vision of the night, Yaakov, Yaakov, Vayomer Hineni, I am present, to do your bidding. Hineni always means the same thing. It's a dangerous situation. I am present. Whatever you say, before you say it, I accept it. Vayomer, and God said, Anochi Yoker Elokei Avicha, I'm the God of your father. That's what God had said to Jacob in chapter 28. I am your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. Al Tiram Yerdam Mitzrayimah, do not be afraid. Don't be afraid. First time in chapter 28, what did we say there? Let's see. 28. Vayira vayomar. And Jacob, when God encounters Vayira, he was afraid and he said, how awesome is this place? Here too, do not be afraid, Jacob. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. Ki vagoy gadol asimcha sham. I will make you there a great nation. And the first time, the nation is built outside the land. Always that way. The nation is built outside the land. Every one of Jacob's children, with one exception, is born outside the land. And God said to Yaakov in chapter 46, I will go down with you, Yaakov, and I will bring you up. And what did Jacob see the first time in Beersheba? It's the same story. First story is going down, going to Laban. The second story is going down to Mitzrayim. The Torah sets it up as an identical experience. And what's interesting is, there's a word, however, that appears three times in the second story, and not three times in the first story. The word is Anochi. I. Me, says God. Me. The emphatic I. And Jacob says, Hineni. And I suggest a way of reading is, what God is saying to Yaakov, what the Chumash is saying to Yaakov is, Yaakov, you know what it means to be in exile. Because you were there. Story of Laban is about Geirut and Avdut and about Inui. You know what it is. But let me tell you something. This is my will. Anochi. I want you to do what I tell you to do. I want you to accept it knowing what it means. Hineni. And the point of it though, the deeper point over here, is that it's actually the first time he leaves, his mother had said, you go for a few days. I'll call you back in a few days, son. Right? Yomim achadim. And then God appears to Yaakov in the vision. V'yineh anochi imach. There's one anochi. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to guard you. I'm going to protect you. I'm not going to abandon you. And Yaakov saying to himself, protection, not abandon me. Don't worry, Yaakov, right? Don't be afraid. I'm going for 2 weeks. I got a ticket. 2 weeks I'm coming back. So what does God say? Not what your mother says. She's going to bring you back. She'll never bring you back. You have to understand, you're not just going for a little visit. You're going there for a long time. In fact, you're going to a place nobody has ever returned from. You saw Yaakov Ragor, Vayelach Arzah b'nei Kedem. That's how the next chapter is. The land of the east. Kedem, the book of Genesis, is the place from which you never return. It's not going to be so simple, but I promise to be with you. I promise to protect you. You're going there to build to build a nation, to build a family. And the same thing is true in the second instance. I'm going to go down with you. I'm going to come up with you. The Yosef, Yoshit, Yodo, and Joseph will put his hands over your eyes. The problem is, Joseph will be there when you die. You're not going to visit Joseph. That's the point of the Chumash. Ah, I want to see my son Joseph before he dies. It's not about seeing Joseph. That's not why Yaakov goes down to Mitzrayim, to see Joseph. He comes down to redeem Joseph. Joseph is lost. There is no tribe of Joseph, my friends. It doesn't exist. Joseph is alienated from the brothers. He meets Yosef with his Egyptian dress, with the Egyptian chariot, with his wife Osnat. His father-in-law is the priest of On. His sons are not recognizable. Mi'ela. And Yaakov brings Yosef back, actually. Teaches Yosef. And he brings Yosef back into the family through Joseph's children, Menashe and Ephraim. So there's Joseph has two portions, but in a sense there's no Joseph. You're there to bring him back. The family is not complete without Yosef. So he has to bring him back. It's all about building. It's not about a visit. And it's not about going for a short amount of time. I'll see him before I die. It's not about that. It's about the building. You need Yosef. We need all the people. You got to build the bayit. You need all of them. That's why he goes down. And I'll tell you something. I want to conclude with the following. There's so much more to say. It's not even funny. But let me tell you something. Chapter 46, Yaakov goes down to Mitzrayim. And after God speaks to Yaakov in chapter 46, suddenly the Chumash starts in the middle of 46. V'yela Shemot b'nei Yisrael Rabbeim. These are the names. These are the names of Joseph's, of Yaakov's family. They give you all the names, right? At the list of all of the names, in verse number 27, Ubnei Yosef, Ashiyu Adlo B'Mitzrayim Nefesh Dayim. And Joseph's sons in Egypt were two. Then the Torah says, the sum total is 70. Chapter 46 of Bereishit. Then if you turn the pages, and you go to chapter 1 of Exodus, these are the names of Jacob's sons. And the Chumash continues, all the names. Yosef, Yabba Mitzrayim. And Joseph was in Egypt. And how many are there altogether? 70. What is, I would say, the literary function of recapitulating what you have in chapter 46? Not just the names, but the names, and Joseph is in Egypt, and the total is 70. Why does the Torah in the book of Shemot begin this way? By a repetition of precisely what we're told in chapter 46. So I want to make a small suggestion about why the Torah repeats it. What is the literary function? I think what the Chumash is saying to us is this. Yaakov was told in chapter 46, he's going down to Mitzrayim, because this is God's will. And this is where you have to be in order to build the nation. And the Chumash reminds us that the way you go down to Mitzrayim in 46 is the way you went to the house of Lavan in chapter 28, which suggests to us we're talking about a similar experience. And now the rest of it is Yaakov goes to Egypt, he meets Yosef, Yosef saves the Egyptian economy, Yosef empowers Pharaoh, Yosef promises to bury Yaakov, Menashe and Ephraim, Yaakov blesses all the children. And now we start the book of Exodus. And the book of Exodus starts by saying, okay, let's forget about the last five chapters, 47, 48, 49, and 50. Let's go back now to chapter 46, when Yaakov went down. Let's recapitulate. Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, and we had the names, and we had the 70, and we had Joseph. Pick up the story. Erase the last four chapters. God says to Yaakov, I want you to go down to Egypt. I'm going to make you a nation there. I want you to accept it. Hineni. Okay. Then the Torah continues. Joseph dies. That's the next verse. And the next verse is, a new king emerged in Egypt who didn't know Joseph. He said, there are too many of them. Let's outsmart them. Lest they join with our enemies. Next verse. So he placed over them taskmasters. Uman anotol b'siplo sam. So he set upon them inui. And the next verse says, and he set upon them avdus. And a little later, keros. When you read it this way, actually, which is what the Chumash wants, it's actually immediate. In other words, if you read it this way, Jacob went down to Egypt. These are the names, and right away, Joseph dies, Avdus and Imli and Gerus. In other words, the two experiences are actually identical. The Chumash wants you to put those two things together. The house of Lavan, the Gerus, Avdus, Imli of Lavan, and the story of Israel in Egypt, which is the story of Jacob. It's what the Medrash means. Jacob, our father, he never died, actually. In other words, Yaakov experiences. That's the point. The different thing, by the way, and these are the names that went down with Yaakov, and Joseph and the brothers and the generation died. It never says Yaakov died. That's what the Medrash picks up. It says Jacob died, Joseph and the brothers, Jacob never dies. Jacob, from the mythic perspective, Jacob never dies. And this is the story. Jacob experiences the Gerus and the Av again, but Jacob accepted it. That is the Hineni. There's so much more here. That's what I thought is picking up. Let me just conclude with the following observation. There's so much to say about this. So let me say two things about it. One is irrelevant to anything I said here, by the way. I just want to say it anyway. It's a very important point. You know, we are praying, all the time for the restoration of the temple, restoration of the sacrificial service. You know, davening Musaf every Shabbos, right? We're praying to God on Yom Tov, please, right? Please restore the temple. And we pray for many other things. And the question is, how do you understand this? You know, how do you understand we're praying for the temple to be restored? And what it's really about, I think, what it's really about is we think of it in terms of, we say the temple, we don't really mean the temple, we mean what the temple represents. We don't mean that we should have the Korban Pesach, we mean that what the Korban Pesach represents. It becomes a metaphor. And I was talking to my wife about this a year ago, she said, no, that's not correct. That's the modern Orthodox approach. That's not it. It's about something very different, which is a different kind of davening, where you enter into a mythic world. This is actually what it is. Those who can really daven. You enter into a mythic world. You won't find that world around here. You can find it, but it's not here. The entering into the mythic world, you actually are praying for the temple to be restored. You enter into a different consciousness. That's the point. And that's what it means, Yaakov Avinu Lomet. That's what it means that a Malava, that's what the American Jew has lost, actually. The Malava Malka, David the king is there at the Malava Malka. He's there. And Eliyahu HaNavi is there. And Yisrael Saba is there. We've lost touch with this. That's the point. Jacob doesn't die. Jacob is in Egypt, actually. Jacob experiences something. It's in a way the pshat of the Chumash. That's what the Chumash is saying. When God says to Jacob, you will go down there again and you will suffer. And that's what the Chumash says. Let's go back to 46. Let's go back to the names and Joseph. Three, four verses later, Yaakov doesn't die. Yaakov lives forever. That's the point. It's a different way of seeing the world. It's a different conscience. And believe me, it's a different davening too. And we just get to the last point about the Haggadah. Very simple point. Which is, the thing I just told you now is the most important thing of the whole night. I got to tell you, but that's something to think about in the deepest way. Now, let me get to a different point about the questions of the Seder. The Seder is structured around questions and answers. It starts with four questions, the Manishtana. We have the Bright of the Arba Bonim, the four children. We have even the Pesach Masul Mora, as Tabori points out in his Haggadah. In the Mishnah is a statement. Masa al Shem X, Mora al Shem X, as Haggadah's question and answer. Pesach Zosha Onolachim al Shub Ma. Not in the Mishnah. The Mishnah has a statement. The Haggadah has a question and an answer. And as I point out in the Haggadah, the end of Magid. How do we end Magid? With a psalm. B'tzeis Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. It's one of the few psalms that's actually question and answer. Malacha yom ki tanuz hayadein tisov v'yachar. Heharim tzirk rakduch yeirim. And there's an answer. Yilifnei adon chu v'yaretz. It's all questions and answers. At every step, from beginning to end. And one of these children that we have in the Haggadah is the so-called Rasha, the wicked son. And this wicked child says, "Ma avoda hazot lachem. What are you wasting? Basically, what are you wasting your time for? What is the service to you?" Which the writer of the Arba Banim ascribes to this insolent child, and we don't even give the child an answer. We simply say, "Look, if you bavu zeh asar Hashem reid, if he were there, he wouldn't have been saved." Don't even address him directly. One gets the sense that we simply dismiss him altogether. But the truth is that even if we don't like the person who's making the statement, it doesn't mean that what he's saying is actually without some value. He's not saying it in a nice way. The Chacham is much nicer. The Chacham is a sweetheart. The Chacham says, "Listen, I know it has deep meanings. Maybe you'll explain it to me." Of course it means something. Teach me what it means. I don't have a clue. The Rasha dismisses. But they're basically, in a way, asking the same question. Why should you care? 3,000 years ago, we went out of Egypt. Okay, let's say we did. So what? You're preparing for a month for Pesach because you went out of Egypt 3,000 years ago. I mean, how does it speak to me? That's the question. And that is the core question of the Seder. It's not just about the Seder, about all religion. How does it speak? Why should I care? What is the relevance? And the Haggadah actually offers at least two answers to this question. Not in the context of the Arba Banim, but in a different context. In the context of Arami Oved Avi. Of Tseyu Ramat. And the answer of the Haggadah, I think, is twofold. First of all, don't think because it happened 3,000 years ago that it's not relevant today. Because history is actually cyclical. Because the story of Pharaoh isn't just about 3,000 years ago, it could repeat in every generation. In fact, there was an Exodus before we even got there. Look at Lavan. It's the same story. It's not about the historical events. It's about the nature of the experience. That's one answer of the Haggadah. And the second answer of the Haggadah is a much more important one, which is understand something about the experience of Egypt. It's about Gedrus and Avdus and Inri. It's a covenantal experience. It is the context in which we live. Our relationship with God is a covenantal one. And all that, everything that implies, it implies that minimally it's a long-term relationship. It's not a week or 2 weeks or 2 years. It spans generations, it spans different communities. We're part of that covenantal connection. We are connected to every other generation, beginning with those that left Mitzrayim. And every generation is connected to the other. Of course, the covenant is not with a particular person. It's with Knesset Yisrael, it's with the larger community. And because it's long-term, like every relationship, it has its ups, it has its downs, it has its ups again, all kinds of problems. We're in this for the long haul. And this is the context in which we function as Jews. The Hisha Amda Lavoteno means this covenantal context, this defines our relationship. This is the context in which we function today. So it's not about just what happened then. It's about what it means to be a covenantal Jew. And there's a lot to think about. What are the implications of being a covenantal Jew? But that's the answer to a very important question. One we should think about all the time. Why does it matter to us? What is the relevance? That's really the central question of Jewish life, I think. Religious life, certainly. And the question of the Seder. Whether asked by the Rosh or by the Chacham, it's still a very important question. At its core, then, so this is one of the suggestions I make about why did they choose Arami Oved Avi? Arami Oved Avi is a very excellent choice. It's a very short synopsis of, and it refers us back, in a sense, to the three obligations we took upon ourselves. Jacob accepted it knowingly. And Jacob endured it together with his people. Jacob is eternal. Jacob endures the suffering. Gerus and Avdus and Inui. And Jacob was able, in the first instance, to reevaluate his own experience. It became not an unpleasant experience in the house of Laban, and not just a punishment. It became a covenant which actually endures forever.
I'd just like to thank Rabbi Silver for this truly wonderful shiur, and I'd also like to thank and acknowledge the sponsors of the shiur, Ricky and Tilly Hartsock, in memory of Rav Lisher Hartsock, and also Wendy Isaac Schulman, in honor of Rabbi Silver's Sunday morning class in grace.
I can serve the